everybody. It's Shane Love Randerson here on Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready for the truth? The whole truth and nothing but the truth? It's time now for Chandler Unleashed.
Well, guys, here we are for another episode of Chandler Unleashed. It is really the first time that we have been able to go on air, but here we are. Folks, if you have questions or anything, just let us know. We'll take callers. People are going to randomly straggle in here. What we're looking at tonight is we're going to have a discussion, a very truthful discussion about a couple of things. One, the opiate crisis and how it began, how it came to be. We're going to talk about the ways in which we can curb this, the ways in which we can use things that are available to us now to kind of curb this, the ways that it would bring about some downfall of money and reduction of money for folks that that may make some money off of marijuana being illegal, and how marijuana is an appropriate substitute for some opiates. But let's get to talking about first how this came to be. What are opiates? You know, that's a question people commonly ask. What are opiates? Where do they come from? What happened? The big thing is opiates are your pain medicine. They're things like Tramadol, Tylenol with codeine, Lortab, oxycodone, things like that, Percocet, morphine, fentanyl, the things you hear like people being prescribed for pain. It's commonly done, regretfully. Let me get our other hosts on here, last four of your number. Commonly prescribed, and regretfully, it's drugs that are abused because they do give people a euphoric feeling. People now have pain clinics because the opiate prescribing got out of control, and people had to, the state had to kind of step in because we had people dying from opiate overdoses and sometimes not even meaning to. They just took a couple and they didn't even realize that it was a bad deal. But now we're in the middle of a crisis. So let me tell you how we got here. Let me just settle in and tell you how we got here. First show, kind of getting the bugs worked out. This is how we got here. In 2001, we had 9,489 opiate overdoses. It's almost 9,500 opiate overdoses. Fast forward to 2018, this is nationwide, we had 63,367 opiate overdoses. Now, I want you to think about that. 63,367 opiate overdoses, up from 9,489. That's almost seven times as many. So how did we get here? Well, it's real simple how we got here. What else happened in 2001? If you're a nurse listening in, what else happened in 2001? Well, in 2001, what happened was Jayco came along and said that pain was what the patient said it was. Pain was the fifth vital sign. So you had your temperature, your heart rate, your respiratory rate, and then your blood pressure, and then finally, what was your pain? Didn't matter if you had a runny nose. We had to ask about what your pain was. Was that right? Probably not. Now, that's not to say that there were people who didn't have their pain adequately addressed. I will say I've worked in the ER a long time. I can tell you several times that I was frustrated with providers who didn't adequately control somebody's pain. But what happened in reaction to that is we went too far to the right of that and said, okay, now we got to ask everybody's pain score. If you're here with a rash, what is your pain? And that's what led to this opiate crisis. Because once we started doing that, well, now that you mention it, Doc, I think my pain's probably about a 7. Really? Because you were on your phone and you were like eating a cheeseburger and your pain's a 7? And our pain scale is, you know, really subjective, because you can tell people 0 means you have no pain. 10 means that your leg's been ripped off by a bear. And some folks will look you dead in the eye while getting off their phone and tell you that the pain from the poison ivy on their leg is causing them to have a pain that is so severe it's rated a 10. Now think about that. In the words of Jayco, pain is whatever the patient said it is. So that's how we started seeing the increased prescription of pain medication. Let's break it down to Tennessee. In 2018, because the 2019 numbers aren't readily available yet, 500 people died due to what we call natural or semi-synthetic opiates, like Lortab and oxycodone. 500 people died. 827 people died in Tennessee in 2018 due to an opiate overdose on drugs like fentanyl, the synthetic or made in a lab opiates. Now, that's leaving out methadone. Methadone by itself, which is a drug people use to try to get people off of opiates, is in of itself an opiate. 57 people died to it, so less. And then 369 people died due to heroin. Nobody's prescribing heroin. So that's a separate subject to be discussed. It's how people get to heroin. And we'll have a discussion about it on another broadcast. But the thing also that's interesting about those statistics is most people who died from these overdoses were in the 25 to 44 age range. Their age group was 25 to 44. So a rather young demographic of people were dying from opiates. So Jayco kind of started this mess, but why has it continued? Well, some insurers have tied reimbursement to patient satisfaction. The patient's happy, they rate you higher, and you get paid higher. Go on and look at health grades. You'll see that my health grades aren't that great. Go look at my Google reviews. People aren't happy when you tell them no to narcotics. And you know what they do? They give you a bad rating, which is insane. It's absolutely insane that people are getting dinged for doing the right thing. We have had people threaten our staff. We've had people threaten to kill one of our providers. We threatened to beat up one of our providers because we told them no. A lady walked in and slid Dustin, one of my employees, a note one time, and it said, I need Addies, Gabbies, and Perks. Now, when you come in and you ask for medicine by their street names, that's a big red flag to us that maybe you don't need those medicines. That maybe you're going to do something other than take them. Maybe you're going to go and divert those medications to the street and exchange them for maybe heroin. The other issue is providers are tired of fighting with patients about it. If you look at who's writing a lot of these narcotics, it's older docs. It takes us exponentially more time to tell a patient no to narcotics than it does for the patient to just get their script and be on their way. And that's one big reason why you see a lot of older docs just writing whatever they want, because it's just easier to get people out the door. It's just easier to get them out the door. It's not right, but that's the path of least resistance. The other issue is some providers get greedy. Let me give you an example. There are schedules of drugs. Schedule 1 drugs are cocaine, heroin, things that we're never going to write. Ironically, marijuana is in that. Schedule 2 drugs are drugs like Percocet, Lortab, morphine that you write, but you can't write refills on. So those are drugs that we call Schedule 2s. Well, the problem is you have to bring those people back in every month and see them and do a drug screen. not a problem. It's just that's the process. Schedule 3 drugs are drugs like Tylenol, codeine, or tramadol. Seen, and if they're stable, you really only have to see them about every 6 months. So Schedule 3 drugs, the prescribing of those requires a lot less work than Schedule 2 drugs. And you may ask yourself, well, my goodness, why in the world would a provider want more work? Well, let's do some math. You see a patient, you do a thorough history of present illness, you do a thorough review of systems, you do a detailed physical exam, you do a drug screen, you check their controlled substance monitoring database. That's a level 4 office visit. For a commercial plan, that's about $114. If you have the patient on Schedule 3 drugs, like Tylenol with codeine or tramadol, they come in twice a year. So for that patient, you're making $228, okay, that you have a patient on a Schedule 2 drug, like Lortab or Percocet or morphine or fentanyl. They're on a Schedule 2 drug. They have to come every month, and you get that $114 12 times a year. Comes out to $1,368, $1,140 more than having them on a Schedule 3. You see now, folks, why a lot of providers are willing to write these Schedule 2 drugs, because it gets people in the door every month when they actually could probably be managed with a Schedule 3 drug, but that financial difference is such that unethical providers get people in, get them hooked on Schedule 2 drugs, and bring them back every month. And that's sad. It's really sad. But that's the world we live in today, where providers are willing to exchange their ethics for a dollar. I encourage all of you to go on Netflix and watch the series The Pharmacist. It talks about such a doctor in New Orleans, in one of the parishes there. Person was seeing 200 people a day. There's no way you can see 200 people a day. Absolutely no way to see 200 people a day. She had pre-printed script pads that had what the pharmacist called the Holy Trinity, Soma, Xanax, and OxyContin. And she would just circle what dose she wanted that patient to have. Wouldn't even write it out. Just circle it. The nurse put the patient's name, date of birth on the script, and the doc already had them signed. And it was cash only. And here's why clinics like that are cash only, because then insurance doesn't come in and audit you. Nobody really knows you exist if you're a cash only clinic. So that's how we got here, folks. We got here because the government, the Joint Commission of Accreditation of Hospital Organizations, or four hospital organizations, in 2001 decided that pain was the fifth vital sign. And then we started having reimbursement tied to patient satisfaction. If you go to an emergency room, you'll notice our local one, and nothing against them, they're just doing what they're told. Everybody wants you to give them an excellent. Make sure you give us an excellent now. We want to remind you you're getting excellent care. Because when those Press Ganey or Gallup polls come back, they want to make sure everybody got an excellent. And that's really unfortunate. It really is. But now let's think about, all right, Chandler, you got all these people with this opiates, and people need pain control. People truly do need pain control. There are some instances where patients have had surgery, it didn't work, and they need pain control. So you want to punish those patients. And that's what's happening, is patients who truly need it are getting punished because so many people are abusing opiates. So what do we do for those people? Well, here's something. I have an idea. There's a natural plant that grows, given to us by God. We have a system in our body that responds to it called the endocannabinoid system. And it treats chronic pain, neuropathy, anxiety, ADD, insomnia, inflammatory bowel syndrome, cancer, chronic nausea, epilepsy, Lou Gehrig's disease, HIV and AIDS, Huntington's chorea, treats all these things, but it's illegal. That drug, my friend, is marijuana, cannabis. And what really baffles me is that if you think about it, I could be a farmer and I could have two fields. On the left, I have a plant that grows. I have to plant it, grows. On the right, same thing. I have to plant it and it grows. I have to water the one on the right. I have to water the one on the left. Then I have to harvest the one on the left. I have to harvest the one on the right. Then I have to dry it out a little bit, and then we gotta sell it. Well, the one on the left happens to be illegal because some government guy said so. Marijuana used to be legal. The one on the other side is tobacco. It's completely legal, and it causes cancer. Causes lung disease, causes heart disease, causes numerous illnesses, bladder cancers, lung cancers, all these things, but it's legal. So, folks, I want to bring on some guests to talk about what the real issue is with the opiate epidemic and why we can't use medical marijuana to treat it, because we want to talk about the different types of marijuana, and I want to bring on Josh Abernathy and Kristen Abernathy. They're the owners of the Healing Grounds farm there in southern Giles County. And then I want to bring on Tyler Whitaker. He is the proprietor of the Whitaker Law Firm, a tremendous attorney, great guy. I think you'll see that as we talk to him. Let's start with Josh here. I want to ask Josh some questions. I'll start off by saying I don't use marijuana. When I went to San Diego, I did some edibles, and I've made the unfortunate decision to mix them with wine, and it did not go well for me. I involuntarily got on a roller coaster that no one else was able to see. So let's talk to Josh here and see if we can get Josh on the line. Unmuting Josh. It'll take a second. Josh, can you hear me, buddy?
Yes, I can. How are you, Chandler?
I'm good, brother. I want to talk to you here. First of all, tell everybody a little bit about what you and Kristen are doing down at the Healing Grounds and kind of what your goal is with that.
We're a local family-owned hemp farm. We cultivate the hemp, process it, and then we sell it to various dispensaries, and we also, you know, we don't just do wholesale. We sell to individual clients as well. And if you can't afford it, we actually give it away most of the time. But we don't do any of the oils or anything ourselves. We send our products off to actual laboratories to have it processed. We just grow the flower. That's the cultivation is our main objective.
Gotcha. Now, let me ask you this, Josh. What is the difference, for the folks listening, what is the difference between THC and hemp? Because, you know, you've got some people out there that are listening and go, well, you know, them potheads, man, they just want to smoke weed, so they want to get this hemp, and it's the same thing. We know that it's not the same thing. What's the difference as far as hemp, CBD, THC, how would you explain that to a customer if they called you to ask?
Well, it's all cannabis. It's all the same plant, but the short answer is breeding. You know, hemp is basically started out just using its fiber, very low THC, but high in CBD, which is your anti-inflammatory, also it's good for seizures, helps you sleep. You know, and then on the other end, through selective breeding of these plants and different genetics, that you can raise the THC level up, and that's where you're getting your medical strains, you know, your medical sativas and your medical indicas. It's the same plant. It's just through selective breeding, it's either bred to keep the THC level low, and you use those genetics for hemp, or you can breed it together. Because if you take a hemp plant, and a regular cannabis plant that has THC. You breed those two plants together, you're going to produce seeds that will in turn grow a plant that has THC levels that are higher than its original hemp mother or father. It's the same plant. The difference is just how it's bred and, of course, the laws, unfortunately.
Well, you mentioned the different strains. Tell us a little bit more. You said sativa and indica. What are the different effects that are produced by each strain? I've done a lot of CME over this, and, you know, they recommend for, you know, we went over the list of things that it helps with. You know, they recommend, you know, X for insomnia, and then this strain for ADD, this strain for epilepsy, this strain for chronic pain. Kind of tell us the differences between the two, if you don't mind.
Well, it's two basic categories, and it's sativa and indica. Your sativas are your daytime strains. That's what's going to give you energy, help you focus, activity, also pain relief. And it's an entourage effect of all the cannabinoids that's in there that you have with both strains, sativa and indica. Both are great for sleep, appetite, pain relief. They both reduce the growth of cancer cells. They both are anti-inflammatory. The main difference is, and this is real simple, sativa is your morning time strain, gives you the energy, you know, like your cup of coffee. Indica is your nighttime. It makes you sleepy, makes you relax. And if you smoke too much or ingest too much indica, you won't be able to do anything but sleep. You know, it has to be regulated and used properly, and that's the problem. You know, you hear these bad stories of people saying, well, I had a horrible panic attack or this and that. Well, that's because it's illegal, and you don't have a professional telling you, hey, you know, don't ingest that much. You're listening to some guy down at the corner store. So,
yeah, you're listening to the guy that, you know, passed the seventh grade barely and decided he was going to be a sole proprietor of a cheap weed company. You know, that's where you see, yeah, I mean, you see these kids that are dying. They bought weed. They didn't know they were buying other things, and they end up having a seizure and dying.
Exactly. And you don't know what's in it.
Well, and that's why legalization would really help, because then it's like going to the store and buying eggs. You know you're getting
eggs. It's regulated.
Exactly. Because it's regulated. You know,
yep.
Let me ask you this. What are the ways in which THC can be consumed? Now, I'll tell you what I saw in San Diego where it was legal is they had these little tablets called ProTabs you could take. They had X amount of THC in them. They had cookies you could eat. They had vapes you could use. They had the actual flower there that you could buy. What are the different ways that THC or medical marijuana even could be consumed?
That's a great question, and there's so many different ways, and they've come about through the regulation in the legal states. You know, they've been able to actually research these things and come, you know, to put that in tablet form. But, you know, you can eat it. You can make these oils at home and butter, and you can put it in any food and eat it. They actually have inhalers now. You've got your oral oils, which are tinctures that you put under your tongue and ingest. Vaping, of course, the capsules, like you said, and then, of course, you can smoke. And I'm not telling anybody to combust a plant material and smoke it, but the studies have shown that the effects, the cannabinoids that reduce the cancer cells actually kind of offset that to where cancer doesn't. You know, for a long time, people said, well, smoking marijuana causes just as much cancer as smoking cigarettes. Well, that's not true. It's not true at all. The entourage effect of all the cannabinoids actually does the exact opposite. But it's all about bioavailability. And smoking gets it in your body the fastest. Vaping and smoking. If you're hurting really bad and you need to feel better right then, those are your two go-tos. The rest of them, you know, like the tinctures and things. Tinctures. You know, you're still going to, that's one of those things with the body. It has to get in your system. You need to do it once in the morning, once at night. You know, and these varied methods. And, you know, eating edibles and things like that, they just have different effects. And the problem with that is if you're eating edibles in a non-regulated area, you could eat too much, and that could be horrifying, you know.
Well, one thing that you see is this hyperemesis from cannabis. You know, when we do the CMEs here, that's one thing they talk about is out in Colorado, when they made it legal, people used a ton of marijuana at once. And they started seeing this influx of people to the ER with vomiting from marijuana use. But I would posit that, you know what, if I go drink a whole fifth of Jack Daniels,
I'm probably
going to vomit too.
Yeah, and possibly die. You know, you can't ingest enough cannabis to kill you. It's just not possible.
Well, and that's the thing. There's not been any death associated. You know, back where we were talking about last in 2018, 63,000 people dying from opiate overdoses. There's never been a single documented death from the use of cannabis. There's a kid out and let me just go on and cover all the DAs. And that stands for dumbasses, not district attorneys, but sometimes they're the same. Let's go and talk about the kid in Las Vegas, because that's the first thing everybody wants to bring up. There was a kid in Las Vegas who was schizophrenic, and he smoked a lot of weed and jumped out of a hotel window. Well, folks, if you've ever seen a schizophrenic patient, the likelihood that they might jump out of a window, pretty high.
It's probably already high.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty high. It happened to be that he also smoked marijuana. Now, the people we tell not to smoke weed are people with schizophrenia, because we know that it can make that worse. But that's a very small part of the population, and we shouldn't limit the ability to treat patients with chronic pain with a natural substance just because there's a small demographic that can't use it. I mean, we don't stop treating strep throat with amoxicillin because there's a small demographic of people that are allergic to penicillin. I mean, we just don't do it. That's not how it works, and it's not rational. Let me ask you this, and then we'll ask Tyler some questions here. What do you see as the economic benefit of THC, even if it's medicinal and not recreational? Because I think we both would agree never going to be recreationally legal until it's medicinally legal and the legislators see that, okay, everybody didn't die, so maybe we could make this recreational. What do you see as the economic benefit, let's just say to you and your household, if we make this legal?
It would be astronomical. You know, just in, you know, my household, I don't know the licensing fees and everything else are so high that I don't even know if that would be an option for us right now. But for the state, for the people that can't afford the licenses, it would be astronomical for the state. You know, Colorado, $1 billion in 2019 of sales. You got Arizona did $406 million. Oregon did $502 million. Washington, $975 million. And then they do the taxes, 15% on your cultivation side and retail side, and then it's another 15% that the customer pays. They're getting 30% of this money. We could build schools, roads. I mean, it would take so much stress off of the taxpayers, you know, and it opens the door for tax money to do way more good than it's doing right now, you know.
Well, other things that we could do is use some of that money for the folks that are addicted to fentanyl to try to get them some help.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And cannabis has been shown in trials to be great for that. You know, well, if it's just a replacement, you know, it's not an opiate, and, you know, it's not going to kill you, and you're replacing that, and it's not a Subutex. It's not a Suboxone. You know, it's a natural plant that's here. And the only thing dangerous about it are the laws.
I agree. And, you know, and at some point we'll talk about Ibogaine and what it did for me. It's another plant, not a drug, that cures depression. and it's illegal in the United States. I haven't been depressed a single day since I had my treatment in Rosarito, Mexico last February. Hadn't been depressed a single day. That didn't mean I hadn't been a little irritated or a little worried, but hadn't been depressed or I wanted to hurt myself. But it's illegal because it would destroy the pharmaceutical industry relative to depression. And that's part of this with medical marijuana, too, is they're afraid it's going to destroy the pharmaceutical industry. But there's another industry that it would definitely affect. And, Josh, I'm going to put you on mute here for a second. There's another industry it would definitely affect, and that is the legal industry. Now, I will say this guy, before I bring him on, Tyler Whitaker is one of the most honest human beings on earth. You'll hear that, you know, there's no such thing as an honest lawyer. Well, I'll tell you, this guy is honest as the day is long. And I'll tell you how honest he is. When I screw up, he calls me on it. And that's what I need in my life. I think any of y'all listening will agree with that. He'll say, you know, I don't think you should have done that, man. It's a bad move. So I'll tell you, he has been a great guy to have as an attorney. He's been a great corporate attorney for us, and he's also been a great friend. Let's bring Tyler on here. Tyler, can you hear me, boss?
Yeah, I'm here. Are you there?
I'm here. First of all, everybody, let's talk about Tyler's law practice. It's up in Lebanon, correct, Tyler?
That is correct. I focus primarily on criminal defense, do a little family law, obviously some business litigation, and some probate. So.
And guys, if you ever need Tyler, his office number is 615-444-5511. It's a little drive to Lebanon, but I'll say this. Sometimes you need somebody that's from out of town to do your case. And Tyler is your guy. And he's got a good partner and Josh Robbins, who is a tremendous individual, too. Tyler, let me ask you a couple of things here about marijuana. What are the typical charges that you see people being charged with associated with marijuana?
Well, I mean, obviously you have simple possession, which not until your third offense does it become a felony. So it is a misdemeanor, and very rarely do people ever get convicted of a third offense, simple possession, simply because so many of those get pled out to something else. If they're caught with another substance, which is a Schedule 3 or a Schedule 4 or Schedule 5, marijuana being a Schedule 6, a lot of times as a part of a plea agreement, you'll see the marijuana case dismissed in lieu for the prosecutor to get his conviction.
Gotcha. Now, and I want to point out, guys, the legal schedules are different than the medical schedules. When, Tyler talks about marijuana being a Schedule 6, that's the legal system. Then level
it
one.
It does go with one being the most serious up to 7.
Right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, boss.
Yeah.
Well, what is the average? Let's say I get charged with simple possession of marijuana. What's the average out-of-pocket cost that you're seeing with court costs and attorney fees? And what's the average cost that you're seeing people have to put out over marijuana, simple possession?
I would say around total cost $3,000, maybe $3,500, up to, you know, $5,000. It depends on, and obviously that's total cost. That's court cost, fines, assuming that you're convicted of at least something. When you have, you know, most people, it seems like have numerous charges, and obviously your attorney's fees and time off work and things like that. And then the majority of the time when people are charged with a crime, they go on probation. And so the cost of probation is, you know, anywhere depending upon the county you're in and the type of probation system you're in. Some are ran by the government. Some are ran privately. Anywhere from $30 to $50, $60 per report. And reports can be weekly or they can be monthly. And that's just, you know, kind of an ongoing cost.
Right. Well, and that's one of the points I wanted to make. You could be using marijuana right now, which I know I have patients that do that to help with their pain, and these people are risking $3,500 at least in court costs and lawyer fees just to not take opiates or not take as many opiates. You may have missed the first part of this conversation, Tyler. I pointed out that in 2001, we had 9,400 deaths nationwide due to opiate overdoses. Not a large amount of people. But in 2001, Joint Commission, which is kind of the hospital police, they decided that pain was the fifth vital sign. And so we had to start asking people, what, no matter what they were there for, whether it be a rash or a bump on their nose or something like that, an asthma attack, what their pain was. Well, that opened the door for if anybody said they had pain, then you had to treat it. And so that's part of the reason we have found ourselves in this opiate crisis. Now, what if somebody does get convicted? You said they're on probation. How long are they usually on probation, a year?
Well, simple possession, which is an amount is not necessarily set as far as if you have this, you're possessing it, it's a felony versus casual possession. Casual exchange, simple possession, the number that the law puts on it is 14.175 grams. But that isn't the actual weight. It's what creates a presumption that the marijuana was possessed with the intent to redistribute it, which is then, in fact, a felony. So somebody could possess an ounce, but if the circumstances were such that it was their own, such as they didn't have scales or they didn't have baggies and they, the circumstances around it, they had something to smoke it with, they looked like it was for personal use, then in the officer's discretion, they could charge them just with simple possession. Whereas they could also charge somebody who has a smaller amount of marijuana than 14.175 grams with marijuana for resale, if in fact they caught them doing that on a live wire, or if they if they found that amount, but they on their person or in their home or wherever, but they were able to demonstrate through the circumstances surrounding it that they beyond a reasonable doubt possessed it with the intent to distribute it. That's the felony language. It's whether you possessed it essentially for yourself or you possessed it with the intent to distribute it. And so that's where that's how the law in Tennessee with regard to marijuana works.
Gotcha. What are the socioeconomic effects? Like, what are the effects for a person who is found guilty of, let's say, a simple possession charge, and then they have to do probation and all this? What is that effect on them? Do you see that it affects their employment, that they're having to take off to report to their probation officer? I assume these probation offices are open bankers' hours, 9 to 5, 8 to 4. Does it impair people's ability to hold down a job because they have to go see their probation officer? And I would assume as soon as somebody says, hey, I'm on probation, some employers may go, ooh, I don't know if I want to hire this guy.
Yeah, both of those points are right on. I see it affect people's ability. I have clients that oftentimes it's really hard to make it to probation, and it's simply because it's hard to ask an employer to routinely take an hour, 2 hours, however, wherever you got to report to probation, get there and get back to work, or, to leave early every other Friday afternoon or even once a month when it's for probation. They're not going to be the first guy to get the job.
Right. Well, it's a shame. There are plenty of people who – like I said, we know that this helps with pain. We know it helps with anxiety, and people aren't dying from cannabis. It just simply isn't in the truth. But let me ask you this: what does the legal system look like if marijuana became legal? Let's say it became recreationally legal. What does that do to the legal system as far as the number of people that are coming in your door? Obviously, nobody would have marijuana charges, and I wouldn't think probation would drop. DA staff may not need to be as plentiful. What do you see happens if they legalize marijuana, let's say recreationally?
It certainly unclogs the general sessions courts pretty significantly, which is where misdemeanors are handled, and felonies can start in the state of Tennessee, but a lot of times on a controlled by, the district attorney will take it straight to the grand jury, which means the case starts in criminal court. But it for me personally, it's probably going to give me less clients, but I understand that people need it, you know, for certainly for medicinal reasons, all the reasons you've cited, which go vary from anything from pain to, I mean, I had an aunt who could not get cancer beat. She had skin cancer. She got THC oil from one of the states that it's legal, treated with that, and went back in, and her doctor was, what have you done? You know, I mean, it was just clearly a complete turnaround, and she said, well, I use THC oil, and, I mean, that is something that really hits home for me because I see her all the time, and just to know what that can do for people and the fact that it's illegal to use is mind-boggling at times.
Well, and, you know, when we think about why it's illegal, you know, you have to think how Capitol Hill works. There are lobbyists from, you know, the Bureau of Prisons, the Sheriff's Department Union, the Sheriff's Union or the Sheriff's Groups, things like that. Big Pharma, of course, is a huge proponent of, of legalizing marijuana because it would take away the number of prescriptions written. We talked about what a marijuana case costs. What do you see with opiate possessions? Let's say somebody gets busted and they have 20 Lortab in their car that don't belong to them. What does that end up costing somebody, and what are those penalties like? Are they harsher than marijuana? Are they at the same level? Or, like, are we not?
Those are – it goes back to the they possess it with the intent to distribute it or not, or was it a simple possession? You can have that in fields as well. Whereas possessing marijuana, the first level anyways, which is a class – hang on, let me think here. It's a class D felony, which carries 2 to 4 years as a first range offender. It's a chart that you look at, essentially, sentencing is. And so you determine what the offense, what classification is that. There's A, B, C misdemeanors and A through E felonies. You determine that classification, and then you go and look at this chart. And so, but no, it's significantly enhanced penalties for pills, depending upon what pill it is, certainly. But your opiates are Schedule IIs. Possessing that with the intent to distribute it is going to carry 8 to 12 years at 30% for a first-time offender. What that means is somebody's going to do 8 to 12 years at 30% before they are release eligible on parole. So that's when they will go up for parole after they've served 30% of that sentence.
Gotcha. Well, and to me that's telling because that tells me the legal system knows that opiates are exponentially more dangerous than marijuana.
That's a fair point. And I think, I mean, even the medical field would tell you that. Certainly the laws reflect that the legislature has enacted, yet we still have laws that are contrary to what those laws would indicate.
Right. Well, Tyler, we appreciate you, brother, and glad to have you on the show. And, guys, again, if you ever need a good attorney, Tyler practices here in Maury County. He's willing to come down. His office number is 615-444-5511. And I'll tell you guys, he's not an attorney that you're going to call and leave a message and he's going to get back with you 6 weeks later. Tyler's responsive. He's a good dude. He wants what's best for everybody. And he's honest with you. He's not going to rip you off. He's, you know, he's told me plenty of times, I don't think this is a good move. I don't think this is the right thing to do. So if you need a good attorney, a good criminal defense attorney, certainly a marijuana charge, holler at Tyler Whitaker. He's up there in Lebanon. He's not part of the system here. And I know that's a concern for a lot of people. But Tyler's a good guy. And, Tyler, thank you for joining.
Hey, thank you for having me on. Have a good evening.
You too. So, folks, I want to bring on another person. I want to bring up a good point because people talk about how awful marijuana is and how terrible it is and all this other. So I want to bring on somebody that that knows, just like I do, that there is a pill out there that contains marijuana. It contains a derivative of it, dronabinol. I'm going to bring on Kristen here. Kristen is a bachelor's prepared nurse. She's in her nurse practitioner program. She and Josh both own the Healing Grounds. Kristen, are you there?
I am.
So, Kristen, in the nursing home, you and I both practiced there at one time. In the nursing home, for patients that wouldn't eat, what did we give them?
Well, you know, we would try some Remeron. We would always do nutritional supplements and stuff like that. Marinol is, I believe, the drug that you're referring to. There's so much, so many restrictions that are put on that that it's almost hard to write a prescription for that. Most providers don't want to, but it has been shown to definitely increase appetite.
Well, and that's why when you look at it, you know, it is indicated for anorexia and weight loss in the HIV population. And it works. You know, I wrote it when I was there at the facility. And guess what? People gained weight. Now, we had to jump through 3,001 hoops to get it approved by the insurance because here's where it gets you. 10-milligram tablets twice a day, or 10 milligram capsules twice a day, are $4,788.29 a month. That's
which
an
is
expensive
ridiculous.
Medicine. Yes, that's an expensive medicine to get people to eat. But you know what? It works. And it works, and we can take from that that if that medicine works, that THC would work if medical marijuana was legalized. Kristen's done some clinical for me, and you've seen various patients. You know, chronic pain is a real thing. There are a lot of people who may say they have it, but they don't. But there are people who legitimately have chronic pain, and marijuana would help with that. Medical cannabis would help with that. The problem is that law enforcement, and I'm not saying all law enforcement, but law enforcement isn't able to seize your property. The plant's made legal. You know,
right. You're exactly right. And I want to go back to what you said about, you know, an increase in appetite. A couple years ago, Israel actually did a study where they went into a nursing home. And the way that the endocannabinoid system works and the way these cannabinoids work on the different receptors, it works like a Goldilocks effect. So, you know, kind of like the porridge might be too hot, it might be too cold. You want it to be right in the middle. So that's why these cannabinoids work like that. That's why people say they work like that. So, like, they took a bunch of people in this nursing home. Some of them were overweight. Some of them were underweight. They started administering THC to these patients, and they saw that the ones that were overweight actually started coming back down more towards their normal BMI. The ones that were underweight actually gained weight and started coming closer to their normal BMI. So So the way that the cannabinoids work together in that entourage effect that Josh was talking about earlier, it actually, it kind of just levels everything out. So, you know, it's been shown to do both, not only make people gain weight, but also make people lose weight at the same time.
Awesome. You know, I promised myself, Kristen, that I would not make this episode about our lovely district attorney, but our district attorney for the 22nd Judicial District decided to post on social media that chronic pain and chronic nausea were not real. And that people just want to smoke weed, and they all just come on out and say, I want to smoke weed and get it over with. Well, it's not really the truth. The truth is people don't want to hurt. People with diabetes don't want their feet to be on fire all the time. He cited this article, or maybe it was even a little book, that was written by not a physician, but the husband of a physician that was known for writing fiction, and about how marijuana killed all these people. Well, this is not true. So I want to just throw this out there to you, Kristen. If I were to host it and we could get Brent come on board and do an interview, would you be willing to have, because you're one of the most knowledgeable people regarding medical marijuana out there, would you be willing to have a very civil debate with Mr. Cooper? And maybe we can inform him of some facts, provide him with some facts, and maybe can change his stance on medical marijuana. Because as long as we have DAs that are willing to go in front of the state legislature and talk about reefer madness, you know, we're not going to ever get this legalized. You know, last year it was voted down in a subcommittee by a surgeon. Well, I guarantee you that surgeon writes plenty of opiates after surgery.
Right.
You know, we had a DA who went up there and told a bunch of nonsense. It wasn't true, and how people were dying and how people were causing wrecks being high and whatnot. And it just reflected their lack of knowledge of the two different strains of THC. And I think that's
all it is. I'd be happy to talk to Brent. You know, I think that's the major problem, is that all the reefer madness stuff did come out a long time ago when all these people were listening to it and they actually started believing it. So, you know, to Brent, I would love to talk to you about it. I don't think that it's necessarily that Brent's like trying to be the anti-marijuana guy or that he's trying to be a bad guy. I think that it's just a lack of education on the issue. And I feel like the more people that we can actually educate about it and teach them the benefits of it and let them see how it would not only be beneficial to patients, but also be beneficial for our economy. You know, I think that once we do that and let them see the light as far as that goes, I think that a lot more people would be on board. And as far as law enforcement goes, you know, I've talked to a lot of law enforcement officials. I've got a lot of friends that are in law enforcement, and I haven't heard a single person say, yeah, it needs to stay illegal. Most of the people that I've talked to in law enforcement say they need to go ahead and legalize it, because not only would it make our job easier, but with all of the, you know, legalization of hemp and stuff recently, there's just no way to tell the difference. And, you know, it would cut down on so much of this tit for tat when it comes to, you know, trying to uphold these laws, because that's what they were sworn under oath to do. So they want to do that the same way that me and you want to take care of patients, you know? So I feel like the more people that we can educate about this and the more people that we can get to listen, you know, show them the facts, show them the studies, let them see what we're seeing, I feel like that would be really beneficial for them. So yeah, definitely, Brent, I would love to talk to you. You know, me and Chandler both, and not only just talk to you, but, you know, show you some studies. And I realize that it's still illegal on the federal level, but it is for all these other states that have legalized cannabis, not only for medicinal use, but for recreational use as well.
Well, and Kristen, I appreciate that. He probably is not going to debate me because, you know, I'm what they call a jerk. But I think that definitely it would be great for me just to be a moderator and you and Brent to talk on here, because maybe it is that Brent's just misinformed. I will say this. It's interesting for you to look at who uses CBD oil and gets relief for arthritis. A lot of those people are what we call the silver-haired voting block, and those are your 65 and older folks, the folks that kind of put Brent in office. I think it's reasonable to think, hey, if my parents are using this, and I'm just using me as an example, if my parents are using this, then maybe I should go talk to them about how it helps their chronic pain. But anyway, Kristen, I appreciate it. I want to take one more caller here. And Kristen, thank you again for what you and Josh are doing. Y'all are wonderful people. I want to
thank you for having us on.
Well, you're wonderful. One more time, Healing Grounds. There's a website, right? Or Facebook?
Yes. We're on Facebook, Healing Grounds on Facebook. And then also you can call us anytime. My number is 931-292-3161, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Well, thank you for what you're doing, and thank you for helping people. Kristen's a tremendous person. I want to go to J.P. Jones. A lot of you remember JP from the podcast we've done before, but JP, are you there, buddy?
Yeah, I'm here, Chandler. Can you hear me?
So let's talk about San Diego. We went to San Diego where marijuana was recreationally legal. How many dead people did we see on the street?
You know, I didn't see any dead people on the street, I gotta say.
How many zombies did we see?
You know, I don't recall seeing any zombies or anybody that looked like they were, I don't know, publicly drunkard.
Did we see anybody that was just impaired, wandering down the street, aimlessly, just randomly groping folks and begging for money?
I do not recall seeing that.
In fact, the strangest thing that we saw in California was a damn quarter locked on a Burger King bathroom. Would you agree?
Yes, that was probably the most abnormal thing that I saw. But I've also got to be honest, a country boy and never going to the West Coast, I've got to say that I was surprised at the hospitality of people there. It really surprised me. I thought that only the South was hospitable in the United States. But I was very much surprised by the people in San Diego.
Well, and to be honest, we went in, what was it called, Harbor Collective or something. We went in there. It was a dispensary, and everybody was professional. You had to give them your ID. It had to be scanned into a system. You had to stand behind the door before you could go in. And when you went in, they basically had a salesperson that was kind of assigned to you. And it was really professional, and they gave good advice. This strain does this. This strain does this. And I felt like it was a pretty safe place. I'm not one that ventures out into the world of drugs, and I felt pretty good about the place.
You had mentioned earlier, Chandler, about the financial burden of getting caught, let's say, with a simple possession or something like that. My question is, how many people profit off of that one person that gets arrested for simple possession? How many different businesses or corporations make money off of that?
Well, I mean, let's look at it. You have the officers. We need more officers if you're arresting people for marijuana. You need more court staff to kind of process people through. You need more assistant district attorneys to process these. Even if it's in general sessions, that's who is on the opposing side of the defense. Then let's say you get found guilty or you're determined that you're guilty. Then you have the probation side where to do drug screens every month. And like Tyler pointed out, you know, there's not many employers that they're not open on Saturdays, folks, as I'm aware of. Are they, JP? Are you aware of any that are open on Saturdays?
Not that many that I know of. And if you are seeing a probation officer on the weekend, usually you're in trouble. So
yeah, you've done something.
So the point that I was getting at is, how many different people potentially make money off of a person that gets caught with simple possession? You touched on a lot of them. There's also bondsmen. There's going to be jailers at the jail, not just your arresting officer or them, but there are the potential. Sure. I mean, all these different people have a hand in the pocket of the person that is getting arrested, compared to, let's say, if there was a dispensary that you could go to, you're only going to have a couple of dollars per gram, maybe, that goes into the state that the state uses for the people. And why would you want to do that when all these other guys can get a piece of the pie?
Well, you know, I think you're right on there, JP. You know, this is a big industry keeping marijuana illegal. It really is. It's a huge industry keeping marijuana illegal because you want to make sure that you're not bringing cases before a judge that you're going to lose. And that's why most people do the meet and plea deal. You know, and the other thing you got to think about is, you know, there's a statistic out there, over 70% of marijuana cases in the U.S. are fought by public defenders. You know who pays for public defenders?
The people.
The people.
The public.
If we were to wipe this out and make, I mean, obviously it's going to have to be medical and then recreational. That's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to do medical first, prove everybody's not dying. And then go to rec. But here's
because
the point
we're
going to
pretend we're in Tennessee. We're going to pretend we can't look at other states and see what's happening there. Here's a big thing though. Before this coronavirus mess happened, Tennessee was one of the only states, I believe, that had a surplus. We have more money than we know what to do with. So therefore, there was no need for this. The state doesn't need it. The good old boys that keep profiting off people that are arrested, they're going to keep making money, and there's really no upside to legalizing marijuana other than helping the public on many different issues. That's the only good thing that comes out of this, is helping the people, the constituents that put most of these guys in the office. That's the only upside. So therefore, they're not for doing it. It's not profitable.
Well, and here's what else I want to point out is that I was trying to read Facebook at the same time that people are commenting. I don't know if y'all noticed, certain somebody on this call is on Channel 5, live on 5. But nonetheless, people are profiting off of it, and it's just cruel. For a DA to come out and say there's no such thing as chronic pain, there's no such thing as chronic nausea, it's just all made up. You know, I've got plenty of facts that show that is not true. I mean, plenty of facts. You know, I think that we definitely know that there are people who would benefit from the use of medical marijuana. I know that there are plenty of people out there who, listening right now, use CBD oil, and it's a derivative of the cannabis plant, and they get good benefits from it. You know, not to go down a rabbit trail here, JP, but in your lifetime, and you know lots of people who smoke marijuana, have you ever seen anybody die from it?
I don't know of a person that I've ever met before that passed away, was involved in a DUI accident, maybe accidentally hurt somebody else. I don't know of anybody that smoked marijuana that happened to at all. So, I mean, there's this misnomer of pot smokers being, I guess, violent and all that. Let's go originally to how they helped criminalize marijuana in America. Before hemp was, I believe we go back far enough, hemp was a required crop that if you had a farm, you had to grow it for the government because they needed hemp. And then all of a sudden, for some reason, I don't know if it had to do with the development of plastic or chemicals or something like that, all of a sudden we had to outlaw hemp because it made African Americans uncontrollable. They would have uncontrollable sexual urges, and they couldn't control themselves around Caucasian women. So we've got to ban marijuana. Is that
exactly
not
right.
The history? So,
no, it is,
I mean,
exactly
that,
the history.
This thought of, is it the right thing to do, whatever. If you looked at how they criminalized it, was that the right thing to do? I mean, we can look at all of these states that have legalized it and look at the numbers and see, has the amount of rapes gone up? The decriminalization. I mean, that's probably some numbers that maybe a district attorney could look up to prove his case if they did.
Well, I'll say this. You're in professional wrestling. Let's just say there's a reason there's a show called The Dark Side of the Ring, right? So there's a reason for that. And it's because it's a seedy industry, would you say?
I would say at its core, for what it is, any type of entertainment is kind of seedy at its core.
How many guys do you know from the wrestling industry that died from an opiate overdose? I bet you can't count it on both hands, can you?
There are so many guys that lost their life because they were addicted to painkillers. You can even look at World Wrestling Entertainment when it was WWF, the World Wrestling Federation. If you remember, in the early 90s, there was a steroid scandal. And the steroid scandal was rocking Vince McMahon's corporation, and there was a big fear that he may go to jail for helping dispense steroids to the wrestlers or some nonsense. Well, out of that came their stringent drug policy. When it was first installed, you had Bret Hart speak out about how this was going to have guys that smoked pot to deal with their pain have to turn to pills.
Right.
And if you look at that trend of people that died from opioids, look at when the drug testing was instituted, and then look at when the deaths from painkillers started to happen. So I think for some of these guys, you took marijuana away from them and told them, no, hey, you got to take these pills, and it ended up killing them.
And that's the thing. You know, you have so many people that were loved by a lot of folks. And here's what happened, guys. These pain, just like Josh was talking about, edibles do not act immediately. Pain pills don't either. And so what happens with a lot of these guys, if you look at these wrestlers, they usually have a big neck. And that's either because they're overweight or they're so muscular, their neck's just huge. So when you look at it, they typically have risk factors for sleep apnea. They have a large neck. They have high blood pressure. They are snoring. You know, they have risk factors. They take and they're in there. And JP can tell you, wrestling is a performance sport. It is an art, but the bumps, as we call them, that wrestlers take hurt. JP, there's a video of JP online being thrown into the ropes. The top rope broke. and he landed head first on a gymnasium floor. That hurt, JP.
Well, I mean, it didn't feel good. I can say that. There's definitely no way to, quote, fake that.
Let's use Andy Maples, for example. He was in the ring with Scott Steiner. Scott Steiner picked him up and slammed him onto the ring. Let's talk about what that ring is. It's a mat. It's a cover. It's a little thin piece of padding, probably, what, an inch or 2 inches maybe?
Yeah, depending on the place. Some places don't even have padding.
Yeah, then there's either plywood or lumber, and then there's steel. That's what you're landing on. So these bumps people were taking were hurting them, and so what they ended up doing is they ended up in severe pain. They stripped away their ability to get marijuana and use it with the wellness policy. So you know what? You could use pain pills as long as they were prescribed by a doctor. So what did all these guys who were using marijuana, which was relatively safe, because you know what? Until that policy came along, we didn't see a lot of people dying from drug overdoses other than cocaine and things like that. We didn't really see a whole lot of pills being people's cause of death. Gino Hernandez died, but his death is surrounded in mystery. But we know Gino had a huge cocaine problem. But the Von Erich boys didn't die from a lot of pain pills. They died from suicide. Kerry got on pain pills because he had a foot amputation. But until that policy went into effect, we didn't see all these people dying from these drug overdoses because these guys have sleep apnea. Untreated, they take one pill, it doesn't relieve their back pain. They take another pill, doesn't relieve it, another, and before they know it, they've taken so many that once they do hit and they fall asleep, it suppresses their respiration to the point that they stop breathing.
And let's say, I mean, this doesn't just apply to wrestlers. This goes to athletes across the board. You look at it now, they're just now starting to be lenient in some sports about testing for marijuana. But, I mean, football players, you're talking about full-grown men running at each other as fast as they can and colliding and then falling onto the ground. And they need something for pain. So it's crazy to me how we could treat pain and other things. The mental aspects of it, they want to say, is not here or there, whatever. I've seen it work. I've seen people that needed it and not have it be a completely different person, someone that did not even want to be around compared to someone that, it kind of reminds me of the opposite of effects of drinking. Most of the time when someone drinks too much, you don't want to be around them. When someone's a smoker and they don't have it, it's kind of like they're drunk and you don't want to be around them. It was a weird effect there. But so there are a lot of positive mental aspects to smoking marijuana that helps a lot of people. But like you mentioned earlier, like the analogy with penicillin, for some people, it might not treat them right. For the vast majority, I know it helps them. I can say I don't know too many people that were smoking a joint or eating edibles or consuming THC that got into a fight maybe 15 or 20 minutes later compared to a bunch of buddies that are drinking Jack Daniels.
Right, and here's the thing. You know, our illustrious DA once again said marijuana makes people violent. Well, you know what? So does being an asshole, and I can say that because I'm not on the radio. If you're an asshole before you smoke weed, you're probably going to be an asshole after you smoke weed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and it's kind of, well, it goes back to the drinking analogy. If you're an asshole when you get drunk, probably an asshole when you're not.
I mean, I'm pretty nice when I'm drinking. I'm just saying. But, well, look, folks, I'm glad we were able to bring people on. JP, I'm glad you're back part of a podcast with me. Folks, this all started with the government trying to do a good thing and making pain the fifth vital sign. The downside of it is, it required physicians to treat every little pain that someone had, and they started writing opiates because it was the easiest path of least resistance they could choose. And now we have an opioid crisis, and we have to decide, are we going, this coronavirus will pass, and people will stop dying. But the numbers from opiate deaths are going to continue to be there. Now, it's down a little bit, in 2018 from 17 because people started being more cautious. But folks, we got to decide, are we going to fight this and try to get something that will help these people? Because you can't leave them with nothing. I mean, if people are hurting, you can't leave them with anything. They'll commit suicide or they'll bite off the street. That's just the truth. Let's provide them with a safe alternative in medical marijuana, and let's move forward from there. Because I honestly think that that is the way that we need to handle it. JP, thanks for being a guest. I appreciate you, and keep spreading the good news, sir.
Yes, sir, will do. But like, just on your point, prime example of what happens when you let the government come in and attempt to regulate something that they know nothing about.
Right. I agree. All right, boss. Thank you. Folks, thanks for tuning in for this first episode of Chandler Unleashed. Next time, I've got to figure out what I'm going to do about New York and when I'm leaving. I'll keep you posted on social media. I'll be able to take my phone. We'll be put up at a hotel there. It looks like if they're going to require me to isolate for 14 days when I get back, that tells me that they don't feel like their equipment's very good. So it makes me worry a little bit. So I'm going to place a call again tomorrow. And if that's the situation, then guess who will not be going to New York City? This fellow right here. But folks, keep your heads up. Let us know if we can do anything to help. And thanks for listening.
Are you ready for the truth? The whole truth and nothing but the truth? It's time now for Chandler Unleashed.